Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi. I'm the author of The Atheist Muslim, and with me is Armin Navabi, author of Why There Is No God and the founder of Atheist Republic. Mm-hmm. And today we have with us, and I'm like a bit of a fanboy right now. What I was going to say fangirl, fan, I don't know what the correct terminology is right now, but we've got Matt Dillahunty. So right author off the bat,
Matt Dillahunty, author of nothing.
Author, yeah, that doesn't matter because you've inspired, I think, both me and Armin. So I have to say right at the outset, I love you. Okay. So just
same here.
Take that any way you want. But the thing is, I've been hearing you for a while. I think the first time I met you, was in, I think, 2015. It was Nate Phelps' conference in Alberta.
Yeah.
And you had a debate, I think, with a pastor there. And I just like all of your debates and like your TV show. You're just the way that you argue about the things, the way that you think, the clarity of thought that you have is just something that's hugely inspiring. And Armin has told me that when he wrote his book, you actually inspired him to write his book as well. Is that what you admit on here?
The reason, like watching you and the Atheist Experience and all the arguments and everything, wanted me to compile, summarize most of the arguments in one place, and that you inspired me to write my book. So, yeah.
I'm on.
Yeah, and so I'll just go with a really quick introduction, then we'll just get to talking. I mean, Matt Dillahunty, for those of you, the few of you who don't know, he is from Austin, Texas. He is, as he reminds us all the time, he ran the cable TV show, the webcast and the cable show, The Atheist Experience, and he's been doing that since 2005. That's something that all of us watched. And from then onwards, I mean, he's just done a lot of debates. He's also a magician. He does a lot of magic shows. He's been doing that since he was very young. Most recently, I think your debate with Jordan Peterson actually got a lot of airplay. And we're going to talk about that as well. That's all on YouTube. And you guys should watch it if you haven't already. So, Matt, we're going to get into a whole bunch of topics. Just wanted to tell you a little bit. We have a lot of atheists, agnostics, secularists from Muslim backgrounds that listen to our show. So that's actually a lot of our audience. And one of the reasons we're really excited to have you on is because I think that some of your, the way that you engage with theists and the way you engage with religious people, the way you have conversations with them, the way you've debunked their arguments or answered them, I think, you know, for so many years, there are many people who want to have these conversations with their families in the Muslim world and, you know, with their teachers, with their families, with their community members, their imams. So we wanted to kind of also get an idea of some of the insights you may have on just the art of debate and how to engage people and how that may apply in a world where this kind of conversation is fraught with a lot more, I guess, at this point, many really deadly risks, quite literally, that you don't see as much in the Christian world anymore. I thought that'd be a good sort of conversation to have. But to start with, can you just tell us a little bit about how you started out and, you know, just a quick bio?
Yeah, so a sperm met up with an egg.
Is that self-evident, Matt?
Well, it is now. I'd say that it's a good starting point. The de facto thing is that if you meet somebody who appears human, they probably started with a sperm and an egg.
Okay.
But I was raised primarily Southern Baptist, walked down the aisle at around the age of five to accept Jesus in my heart, was active in the church all those years. And people in the church, including, you know, my parents and others, thought that God wanted me to be a preacher. I was terrified of that. I was terrified of public speaking. I went in the Navy when I was 18, did 8 years in the Navy, got out, worked in the tech industry for a number of years. And then around 2000 or so, I lost my job and pretty much I thought God was punishing me. So for, you know, caring about my career and not becoming a preacher. And so I said, okay, God, if you want me to, I'll do it. And I spent about a year and a half locked up in my house, alternating between playing video games and doing a lot of kind of prayer and study to figure out what it was God wanted. And long story short, at some point about a year into this, I realized that I could not be a Christian anymore. I'd always been a skeptic, but hadn't applied it to my religious beliefs. And shortly after that, I decided it was going to, well, if Christianity isn't true, is there something true in it? Or is there some other religion that has truth? And can I, you know, explore these things? And I joked that for years that I started with Buddhism to figure out if I'd have multiple lives to explore this question, because it's too big for one lifetime to, you know, dig to every religion. And then it led me down a road far closer to philosophy to figure out what kind of God might exist, because that would direct my search better. And ultimately, at least for now, I'm an atheist, skeptic, humanist. And one of the reasons that I was so happy you guys invited me on is because you're talking about your audience primarily being ex-Muslims, et cetera, which isn't the realm that I normally play in. I think in the 14 years I've hosted the Atheist Experience, we've had maybe four or five. We had several ex-Muslim callers, but we only have like four or five actual Muslims call in. And I have no real expertise there. But when you're debating and arguing about these things, first of all, one of the things I point out to people is you don't have to have any expertise. They have a burden of proof. They're the ones that have to convince you. And if they're not making sense, they have an obligation to explain it to you. If you can just sit there and say, I'm not sure I understand what you're saying, and you just ask questions and go this until there's clarity. And if you reach a point where they think they should have convinced you and they haven't, you can at least explain why you're not convinced. Maybe you're not, you know, clear about it. But if the thing is, oh, you have to have, you know, within dealing with Christianity, you don't have to know anything about the Bible. You don't have to be able to read Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic. You don't have to, you know, study through concordances and dictionaries. It either makes sense or it doesn't. And if it's the kind of thing that, you know, I think one of my favorite things to point out is like Alvin Plantinga is a genius Christian who has a modal logic argument of the ontological argument. And this is something that a lot of high-end theologians find incredibly impressive. And I don't. I think it's an obfuscated version of an already foundationally flawed and unconvincing argument. But even if he's correct, he's arguing for a generic God, which would apply to Christianity, Islam, and almost anything else, you know, the kind of creator of the universe sort of thing. And he's presenting an argument that less than 1% of the population has any real hope of understanding. They don't have the requisite knowledge with regard to modal logic, let alone just standard arguments. And so it's kind of funny to me that let's assume for a second this argument was valid and sound, which I don't think it is, that the best argument for the existence of God is something that almost nobody could possibly understand. Right. Why would a God make this so difficult? Mm. One thing that I wanted to do at one point, and it got canceled, there was somebody who wanted to do a team debate. They wanted to get me and somebody else against two preachers. And it was going to be a debate on key tenets within Christianity. And I had this, what I think is a great idea. I was going to get Hina Databoy to do it with me. And anytime they presented an argument for Christianity that would also have applied to Islam, she would to it and say that would apply to Islam as well. So we're clearly not talking about Christianity. I suspect that I would have had very little to say during that debate, maybe a timing and a doctrinal issue from time to time, because the truth is, and this is why I was happy to come here, by and large, the arguments are all the same and tend to be vague. And it's only once you get past, you know, the creator, the origins, the abstract arguments about morality. When people start arguing, you know, like, oh, the Quran reveals scientific information. No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
And the same thing, you know, the same thing happens with the Bible. It's like, oh, the Bible says this. Yes, it also says there's a tree from which you can see the entire earth, which is impossible.
Yeah, the sharpshooter fallacy like that. There's a, you know, I think one of the quotes that I've always liked, and I can't really remember who said it, was that you don't need to read extensively about leprechaunology to not believe in leprechauns.
Right.
Yeah, you know, you don't. I mean, if you can just start your starting point, I don't believe in leprechauns. If anybody says, you know, I can't believe I'm explaining this, but you know that, oh no, you have to read all these books about leprechaunology, and you have to look at what Carl Jung's view was on leprechaunology, and you have to look at all of this, and you can't dismiss it until you read that. Well, you know, they're leprechauns. It's not that they're not.
But the trick is because, well, for leprechauns, you don't have universities and thousands of books dedicated to it, right? You don't have thousands of years of so-called scholars and, you know, people analyzing it. The thing is that if they had done it, it would look so impressive that it would be hard for you to believe that this is based on nothing.
But that's why it's a good analogy. That's exactly why the argument works. It's because, you know, the only reason that what you're talking about is different from leprechaunology is because you do have this thousands of years of people who believed in it, like they believed in a lot of other things that were that we know now not to be true. So, it's one question for you is the 4 or 5 Muslims that you said called your show, but right. What do you recall what questions they had?
You're stealing all my questions. That's a good question. Yeah, no, go ahead.
So I'm lucky if I remember anything about the show after this many years of doing it.
Yeah.
But there were two occasions that come to mind. One's fairly recent where someone was basically going down the line of arguing for particular verses in the Quran that seemed to relay information in hindsight that would be impressive, you know. Oh, it taught us something about science. And the thing that I keep pointing out is this is, quite frankly, a matter of interpretation. It's vague. It's not a scientific book. And it didn't teach us anything. It is only after we learned this through scientific investigation that somebody goes back and looks at what you can interpret this so it fits this. Right. And it's not surprising that faced with the same world and similar minds trying to solve similar problems, that we're going to come up with similar potential explanations for things, just like we have countless superheroes that all have the same powers. Right. These are the things that interest us. And so if you have a problem to solve, there's a limited pool of options. And it strikes me as odd because some of them are like, you know, the description of the fetus that it, you know, it's like, you know, chewed gum or something like that. Do you think that nobody ever had a miscarriage, that they didn't raise animals that, right, you know, where there were fetuses that fell out early?
Actually, you know what? Let me tell you, in the last Muslimish conference, I did a whole talk on the Quranic claims on embryology, and I wrote about these in my book too. But the Quran describes the blood clot, from the blood clot all the way to the flesh covering the bones and all of that. That's chick embryology. Galen and Aristotle wrote extensively about it. All you have to do is crack open a fertilized egg right at the point of fertilization, which is where it would look like a blood clot, or move on to, you know, whenever it's any stage of development, and you will find something in the Quran about it. So unless they had a deficiency of eggs or curiosity,
right,
there's no surprise that some of these claims are. In fact, the funny thing is the Quran never mentions the ovum, which is the source of the majority of the genetic material in an embryo.
In general, there's no example where, because of scripture, religious people came up with a scientific understanding of the world that scientists didn't. And then eventually scientists got to and said like, oh, the scripture was right. It was always the other way around. It was always the scientists discovering something and then the religious going to scripture like, oh, this in our scripture is basically talking about that. You never see them claim that scientific fact first.
And it's interesting that they use science as a legitimate way to show that scripture is a real thing. That actually shows something about how they actually think about science. That's also interesting.
It's even worse than that on a couple levels. And one is that if your ancient text, be it the Bible, the Quran, whatever, had a legitimate scientific explanation for something that was clear and that nobody could have known about in any other fashion, you still don't have a justification for believing that it's accurate until you've done the science to test and confirm this.
Right.
You know,
right.
talks about if it explained the germ theory of disease, which some people will do that. Oh, this is why it tells you to wash your hands. Maybe it tells you to wash your hands because when you got blood all over them, it tastes crappy. You know, you're going on. But if it, even if it explained the germ theory of disease, the time to believe that that is an accurate model is after we have evidence for it, not because it came as a pronouncement on high.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Exactly.
Do you have, okay, so a lot of our listeners are in Islamic countries. We have a lot of listeners in Saudi Arabia, in Pakistan, in Egypt, in Bangladesh. And some of them, they do want to, are interested in becoming atheist activists, but they don't want to risk their lives or their safety or their freedom. Do you have any tips for maybe bringing up these issues without, you know, making people think, asking questions, making people doubt their beliefs without giving away that you are an atheist? Do you have any tips on that?
I want to preface this by saying that it may in fact be incredibly arrogant and irresponsible for me to give any tips like this to someone. I'm never in a position where my life is likely to be endangered because I speak out about something.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to, you know, caution people that if you're in that situation, we'll do everything that we can to be supportive. And I would prefer that people not put their lives at risk, that they find a way to do this. And one piece of advice that I give to, in particular, I've had teenagers, Christian teenagers, who become atheists and then they get cut off from their family. We have to find them new homes. And, you know, their lives aren't in danger. We haven't had to hide them as we have some ex-Muslims. But we, when people ask me about coming out, the one piece of advice I always give everybody is don't make a big deal out of it. Don't do a sit down like, oh, I have something important to tell you. And at least at the beginning, especially if you're not sure how things are, don't use the A label, the atheist label at all. Because it's in much the same way that if you tell me something and I say, I don't believe you, I'm not calling you a liar. I'm saying I'm unconvinced that what you're saying is correct. I may think that you're lying. I may not. I just may be unconvinced. And if you use the language like that, and I don't know how well this is going to translate through various language barriers, but if you use the language of being unconvinced, now, instead of looking like you are in opposition to Allah or in opposition to Yahweh, it now looks like you are just engaged in some doubt. You have some concerns, which is all real and true. And it puts the person you're talking to in a position of wanting to address your concerns so that they can bring you back. And if all you're is asking questions, that's not as threatening as you are wrong. You know, you can say all day about the Holy Quran and Allah, and, you know, this is an abomination, and, you know, science disproves this, and you have no evidence for that. All of that is attacking. And while that can be useful, there's a way to be, I mean, I'm fine with ridicule and mockery and all those things, but those come from a privileged position of safety. I can do whatever the hell I want and
yeah,
really do anything. If you're not in that position, then the best thing to do is to be honest and say, I'm just not convinced that this is correct, or I have doubts and questions about this particular interpretation or this particular school of thought, and get them to defend the positions that they hold. Mm. You may find that that works wonders in getting them to begin to doubt things too, or to get them to acknowledge, hey, you know, I've always struggled with this too. I have concerns about, you know, putting the onus on women to cover themselves so that they don't corrupt the men. Why isn't it the case that the men are seemingly incapable of, you know, not wanting to stick their penis everywhere?
Or not yeah. People?
And if you have those kinds of conversations, you may find that the people you're talking to, while they're not nowhere near ready to acknowledge that they're an atheist or that they want to discard all of Islam or Christianity or anything else, they all have doubts too. And yeah, that puts you guys in a position where you can have a conversation that's not overly threatening and yet still honest.
Mm. Yeah,
honest. Sorry, go ahead. No, I really like that you said, and yet honest, because this leads me to asking you what your thoughts on pushing for changing Islam or reforming Islam instead of going out and trying to make people leave their religion. What are your thoughts on that?
I've kind of danced around on this because, you know, I've talked to you, I talked to Faisal, I've talked to Hina, I've talked to a number of different people about this, and I'm not completely sure. As a purist, I really don't care if somebody wants to reform their religion and make it softer. I want anything that's not true and potentially harmful gone. And I think that if you reformed any religion sufficiently to where only the good was left, you wouldn't have anything that looks like that religion in the first place. But I would also like to live in a world where the worst and most dangerous forms of any religion are gone and replaced with either true, accurate, secular humanism, or at a minimum, a softer version. I don't know how likely it is that that's possible. As a matter of fact, I think in many cases, it may be just outright impossible that there's a power and control element such that I don't know that, you know, on an individual level, you can soften someone's beliefs. But when you have institutionalized religion, when you have religions in control of governments, they become much more rigid. They become less likely to change. So as far as practicality, I really have no expertise and couldn't guess. As a personal preference, sure, I will take a kinder, gentler version of a religion over a harmful one. But I would rather work towards a world where we believe true things for good reasons.
Right. I would rather that as well. I just don't know how could practically, if we remove critical thinking or encouraging doubt, once you remove that filter, I don't think we have much control over where people will land with their, I think whether they come on a nice, kinder version of a religion or a more, you know, violent version of it, it has to do more with their own sense of sympathy and their own moral standards rather than what they're looking into the text. I think
what you said last time was that it was about the method, and we were talking to Stephen Picker. You said that it's about the method, not necessarily the conclusion. If you're using the wrong method to just luckily get to a nice conclusion, that doesn't same flawed method will lead you to a nice conclusion every time. It could lead you to horrible things.
I can frame this with respect to Christianity and even in an abstract sense. If you have a really awful version of a religion and a far more liberal, moderate, friendly version of religion, if those are the only two options, that may be the best scenario because there are more people who are willing to jump to the better one to avoid being in the nasty. But if you create a bunch of steps in weakening, now you create a landscape that can lead either direction. You can take people who are generally liberal theists and by showing them flaws in their reasoning, gradually stair-step them down to the more fundamentalist version, just as like you can go out. When I gave a talk in California 4 or 5 years ago where I said that fundamentalist Christians are the target audience because the liberal Christians, they don't care whether the earth is 6 to 12,000 years old. They're not concerned about that stuff. It's all abstract. They have already rationalized away the very problems that rest with the fundamentalist version. But if there's somebody who's a fundamentalist, who's, you know, anti-evolution, anti-science, and all these other things, when you start chipping away at the foundations of their belief, they're not going to crumble to a liberal version. They're going to crumble to
an atheist
position.
Well, I mean, if you look at two options, people moving towards the religion or moving away from religion, what I think is that, you know, if you look at the liberal theists, they're not liberal because they looked at the Quran and decided that they were fundamentalists and then the Quran convinced them to be liberal. Or we didn't have fundamentalist Christians that look at the Bible and they're like, okay, the Bible is telling me to be a liberal. It's usually outside ideas or challenging religion that made them move away. Even though they're still theists, their ideology is influenced by views outside of religion, not from religion. And I think the problem is that what reformists do is that they take credit for liberal-minded theists and make it seem like the source was religion. And I think that they are actually a good cover for the fundamentalist part of the religion because it kind of gives a suggestion that these texts could lead to liberalism and basically gives them more authority.
Yeah, so Sam Harris pointed out years ago that the moderate and liberal Christians give cover to the fundamentalists because they're pointing to the same book. They're using the same label. The same thing is true within Islam. If there's modern liberal theologians within Islam, they are providing credibility and credence to the more fundamentalist versions. The other aspect of this that's really troubling is I'm not in a position to declare who is or isn't a true Christian, but I can point to some positions and say, this is supported by the Bible on any plain reading. And this is not. So when you have a LGBTQ friendly Christian church in San Francisco, they are clearly cherry picking verses, because there are other verses that say, if you allow a man to lie with another man as he lies with a woman, that's an abomination. You're put to death. Mm-hmm. Now, the only way to get to an LGBTQ friendly Christian church is to set aside that verse in its plain reading, go find some other verse that is love thy neighbor as thyself, and use that to interpret. The problem is that the specific should always override the general. If I have a general rule that says don't kill anybody, and then I have a specific rule that says go slaughter the Midianites, those aren't in contradiction necessarily. One of them's a correction. But if you take the specific one about slaughtering the Midianites and argue that the general rule no longer applies and we can kill everybody, now you've got a mistaken reasoning, which is why Westboro Baptist Church, despite being despicable human beings, the foundation for their claims and their beliefs, it is more biblically sound than that gay-friendly church in San Francisco or the church down the street from me that is wanting to be, you know, ecumenical. Let's have everybody in. Let's work with, you know, the imams down the street or the Buddhist temple. Let's, you know, get everybody together. They don't have as solid of a foundation as Westboro does. Mm-hmm. This is, I think, you know, granted, I am no expert on Islam, so I'm not going to be preaching to you guys about this. But I think that applies as well when we're talking about distinctions between Sharia law or Shia, Sunni, Sufi stuff.
I mean, ISIS is one of the examples. ISIS, the majority of the stuff that they do, the majority of it actually is completely consistent with the Quran and the Hadith. The Hadith are the traditions of the Prophet of Muhammad. So it actually is. Most of the stuff is backed by them.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead.
When you say that you're not in a position to say who's a Christian and who's not, the fact is that somebody doesn't follow Christianity doesn't mean they're not a Christian. It means that they're not a very good Christian. I mean, I have no problem defining Muslim and defining Christian. Maybe somebody disagrees. I could just say a Muslim is a person that believes in Allah, Muhammad as the last prophet, and the Quran is the word of God. That doesn't mean that they follow Islam. The definition of Islam is separate from that, right? That mean they might have never read the Quran, they might not follow the Quran. I think the mistake a lot of people make is that when they talk about like a Muslim, they reduce them to Muslim and nothing else, as if they're not influenced by anything else other than Islam. Most Muslims have never read the Quran, let alone the Hadith, where most of the laws and rules and laws come from. Most Muslims don't even speak Arabic, and many of the Muslims that have memorized the entire Quran cover to cover, if you ask them what it says, they have no idea what they've memorized. They just know how to recite it. So they're Muslims, but Islam is not a big part of what their decision-making process for most Muslims, right?
So, I can clarify this. It's easy. When I say that I don't get to identify who or who isn't a true Christian, I'm talking about doctrinal disputes between various versions where the Catholics and the Protestants and the various Protestant stuff. I can look at, so for example, I'm not a Christian. I can also say with confidence, neither one of you guys are Christians.
Right.
Because there's some minimal definition which includes a self-identity. When I say I don't get to decide who's a true Christian, I'm saying I don't have a position or I don't get to assert who is correct in their doctrinal interpretations.
Right.
So I can't say the Southern Baptists have it right and the Catholics have it wrong, although I used to say that when I was a Southern Baptist. But what I can do is argue on behalf of who's making an argument to the Bible as a biblical foundation, whose version is more consistent with the Bible on a plain reading. So the LGBTQ church in California or wherever it is, they are on less firm biblical footing.
Right.
I can't tell you whether or not they've got the one true correct Christian doctrine or not, because that's not my job. I don't have a horse in that race. As far as I know, they're all labeling themselves Christian. I think they're all wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I have one of the ways that I parse this is that, when I talked about it in my book, I made a distinction between Islam and Muslim. So specifically Islamic ideology as presented in the Quran and the Hadith, which I think of as Islam, and the Muslim identity, which is a whole different thing. And this is one of the worst things about religion, any religion really, is that the way that the ideology gets its tentacles into the identity aspect, so that when you criticize certain beliefs, certain ideas, they actually take it as a personal attack on who they are. Right.
You're doing a distinction. I just want to make sure I understand this right, because mm-hmm. I was just talking about doctrinal things, but if you'd asked about Judaism, I recognize that Judaism is both a religion and a cultural identity as well, not a race or anything else. So I would think that, from my limited understanding, and this is why I'm asking to clarify, I would view Islam as kind of, or Muslims as kind of like a merging of that, where there's a cultural aspect identity where people identify with this. Then there are those who adhere to different schools of thought within Islam. Mm-hmm. And then there are like the Islamists and, you know.
Right. And then you have the nominal types too. So I think with all religions that are really, really old, there are aspects of it that, like, I'll illustrate with this with an example. So when you were talking about how when Muslims are talking to their parents, how to come out, don't use the word atheist and all that, the way that I was doing it was actually quite similar to what you're saying. And I told them I was unconvinced, but because the reason that a lot of Muslims get upset when you criticize the religion or when you draw cartoons of Muhammad is that they think of it as an attack on who they are, their heritage, their family, their ancestors, all of that. They take it very personally, even though it's just a criticism of the ideology. So what I had was, when I used to speak to people, whether it was my parents or uncles and aunts or friends, is I would tell them, and I was honest with them. I'm like, I really like the feasts of Ramadan and I like the Eid holidays. I like the Christmas holidays too. I like all of that stuff. So, and I know what it's like to, you know, when you're praying and you're daydreaming and you're not focusing and all of that. I've been through that. So when it comes to the whole Muslim identity thing, I got it locked down. I'm with you. I'm like you, you know, we're the same. But here's where I have a problem with these verses in the Quran. I don't understand why it says this, why it says that. And that is when, as you said, most of them, and I'm not exaggerating, most of them would say, well, you know, I've had a few problems with this area and that area too, but I just choose to ignore it, or maybe it's something I don't understand. So I always notice that when you acknowledge the identity aspect of a lot of these religions, which I despise the fact that they actually get into their people's identity so much. You know, because if I said I don't believe in quantum physics, you'd be like, oh, okay, you don't. But if I said, well, you know, I don't know about this whole evolution thing, then suddenly people take it very personally because it's part of their belief, right? So I think that there is an ideology versus identity interplay that's very complex. And if we can learn to navigate that, I have found in my experience that I end up having much more sort of meaningful conversations.
This is why I like the ex-Muslim movement a lot, because the bigger it grows, the more Muslims will see that Islam doesn't have to be a part of your identity. Like you can't stop being white, or, you know, you can't stop being American. But if you can't stop being a Muslim, that kind of suggests that it's not something that you're stuck with. Like, it's not such a...
Yeah. Armin, I'm sorry. I'm going to interrupt you just for a second, because there's one thing with exactly what you're saying, that it still doesn't go deep enough, because even with a lot of ex-Muslim communities, they get together and they have Eid dinners with bacon.
It's not as big.
Secular Jews still defend circumcision. It's like
But Ali, I don't think it's that big of a deal with ex-Muslims. I mean, I know you see them a lot. I think a lot of people that are not Christians still enjoy Christian culture, and other people that are not Jews still enjoy Jewish culture. I think a lot of people that leave Islam, the vast majority, I know there's exceptions, but most people that leave Islam,
they don't want anything
to do with it. Anything. Yeah. I always remember our friend Yas, when she first heard Arabic verses in the Quran, she would hold her ear so that she couldn't hear it. That's how damaging it was to her experience. Like, but yes, you were going to say something, Matt? Sorry.
Oh, no. So I end up pushing back a lot on, I think the Christianity, especially Protestantism, is in a slightly different category, because while I was certainly raised as a fundamentalist Christian and I am surrounded in it and it has this massive privileged status. Oh, you said I can't stop being white and I can't stop being American. I might actually be able to stop being American.
Okay.
But I get what you're saying. Right. I push back on the cultural Christian thing a lot because I want to enforce a distinction between Christianity and aspects of culture that Christianity claimed that it doesn't own. This notion of, you know, charity or morality, like all these
Christmas
things.
Christmas itself.
Right.
Well, Christmas is a pagan thing that they stole.
Right. The solstice and you're right. Yeah.
My wife and I did a whole video on Christmas because we're huge fans of Christmas. But Christmas in the modern world, I'm pretty sure that as long as it wasn't like you weren't at Christmas Mass, like if you go out in July and stand out in front of a church and as people leave the church, say, hey, I'm going to say a word and you tell me the first two things that enter your mind. And then you start with something like Chevrolet. And then they say two words. And then you say pumpkin patch and they say two words. And you say Christmas and they say two words. I would be shocked if either of those words was Jesus.
Mm.
The things that are going to come to people's head generally with Christmas, including Christians walking out of church, is going to be presents, Santa Claus, family, trees, lights, all of these things that have nothing to do with Christianity. Mm. And it's one of the reasons we did an informal survey for several years down here in Texas where we would drive around various subdivisions to look at what decorations people put up out there. And in a subdivision with 400 or 500 houses, there might be 2 or 3 nativity scenes, and yet there's 5 Snoopies and 18 Santa Claus.
All this other stuff. Well, it's like the Easter thing, right? Eostre, I think that's how you pronounce it. The fertility goddess, Eostre, that's what it's about. The reason that you got from the crucifixion and the resurrection to bunnies and eggs is because she was a goddess of fertility. Yep. And, you know, bunnies, mate, they have a lot of intercourse and eggs are a sign of fertility. And that's where, and even the word estrogen actually comes from.
I think we should try that with ex-Muslims because of a lot of ex-Muslims, because of the traumatic experiences a lot of them have had, they don't want anything to do with Islam anymore. But what I tell a lot of people is that Islam is actually a lot more fun if you don't believe in it. That's,
It is.
And there is a lot of interesting history and stories and like detective analysis of where this verse came from. How did this get here? What hadith? I mean, I think if we introduce ex-Muslims to after they get over the experiences they had, that actually, you know, if you talk about Islam and Islamic history in a fun way, the same way you might talk about the Viking religion, the same way you might talk about the Greek religion or Mayan religion.
Exactly where I was going.
Yeah.
Thor is so much more fun in the Marvel universe than he was when he was an actual god.
Yeah. Right. And we're always going to have Thursday, which is named after Thor. Nobody's going to stop saying that.
That might help ex-Muslims be able to talk to Muslims in a more effective way, right? Because a lot of Muslims, when they talk to a lot of ex-Muslims are just show their disgust with Islam, right? And a lot of Muslims get turned off by that. But if you come and say, hey, I don't believe in this, but this is so cool, then a lot of Muslims might be like, hey, why is this person finding this so cool and still is against
Islam? We need to have a Netflix and HBO series because that's one reason I love Game of Thrones, because if you put Islamic history in film, that's what it would look like. Like all of the stuff from how they treat women to the beheadings and the battles and everything. I mean, they show it so graphically, and I look at it and I think I'm like, this is exactly what it was like.
I have a question. Sorry.
Awesome.
Uh-huh.
Except for the dragons. Yeah, those are just in the book.
I have a question for Matt, because you mentioned, and by the way, how much time do we have? Because I want to make sure we get to patrons' questions. We have some questions in live chat. How much more time do we have?
That's up to you guys. I'm here.
Okay.
Can we do it of like 60 to 90 minutes? Let's do that.
Okay. Okay. So you mentioned when I asked you about some tricks for atheists in Islamic country, you said like you have the luxury of using other methods, and you mentioned mockery as one of them. A lot of people, a lot of even atheists hate that and be like, why would you have to mock religion? Like you can criticize it, but why use mockery? How would you respond to that?
Well, when I say I'm okay with, mockery and ridicule, I don't ever start there. it's not like somebody comes up and says, hey, I'm Catholic. And I'm like, well, that's stupid. And blah. To know that little wafer doesn't actually turn into Christ, that's just ridiculous. And I would never start there. The other thing that I make sure that I caution people about is if I am going to mock or ridicule, it's not going to be mockery or ridicule of the person. It's going to be about the idea. And I know that these ideas get into people's foundation of who they are. And it's always a distinction. I don't think it's ever or likely to be the preferred thing, but I don't think it should be excluded. And there's a couple of really good reasons for that. Number one, I think more and more people are getting their reliable good news from comedians. And I also think that comedians are in the lampooning of religion, making it okay for people to laugh, that you don't feel as attacked when a comedian comes after your religion. Uh-huh. The other aspect is, and I've used this example before, so apologies for repeating. There, when it comes to like Santa Claus, there are kids who just kind of grow out of it. There are others who the night before Christmas get all skeptical and go on a little, an attempt to test out the model. I'm going to stay up late and see what actually happens. There's others who weeks beforehand, because they suspect what may be going on, they're tearing through the closets and looking to see and investigating. And then there's some who just don't have that sort of critical thinking and testing mindset. And unfortunately, and I'm not advocating for this, some of them are on a bus to school talking about Santa Claus, and somebody on the bus is like, oh, you still believe in that, you little baby? And that's mean and cruel, and that's not the sort of thing that I'm talking about, because that attacks the person. But it can have the effect of making them go, hang on a minute, why would somebody make fun of me for believing something that I think is real and justified and that brings me joy? And that can prompt people to investigate. So yeah. I just don't want to take tools out of the tool set. I am not the guy who's like, let's go mock everything all the time. And I don't think that's ever been kind of the.
Yeah. I don't know if this sounds cynical or not, but a lot of times what happens is that if you have a bunch of people who make other people feel dumb for believing something, you don't want to feel dumb. You want to be part of the crowd that actually isn't. You want to feel like you're above that. And I think,
The kid on the bus who got made fun of, that's terrible for that kid. But yeah. If he's sitting next to somebody else who secretly believed and they watched their friend get made fun of, that empathy for their friend of, I don't want to be mocked like that, can be a thing as well, which is why when I'm doing a TV show, I'm not so concerned about changing the mind of the person I'm talking to. I want to present the best case and the best reasons, because I know there's somebody out there watching who thinks exactly like that person on the phone. And when that person winds up embarrassed through their own, poor debating skills, or I want that other person to say, wow, I'm glad I wasn't on the phone, because I would have said what that guy said and I would have looked silly. I better go do some more research.
I actually think that is... what you said, and Armin, you you were talking about this too. People in the Muslim world, a lot of times, at least I remember, a lot of them are so frustrated because they can't speak out and they're censored and they're like oppressed by their governments, by their families, by everybody's. Is when they do get a chance to speak, they tend to be very aggressive and very sarcastic and very mocking in a way that this is what I've noticed. They like, for example, Richard Dawkins. They love Richard Dawkins because they feel like the respectful dialogue is kind of a privilege for people in open societies who can speak freely, right? So sometimes I've actually noticed, at least in my crew, when the sort of the underground atheists and secularists would talk among each other, that there was a lot of mocking, a lot of, there was some religious person trying to defend it. They were brutal with them.
I was just going to say that how great the example Matt gave was, because this is actually something that we see on Atheist Republic and other pages, is that when you actually make fun of the idea, you get more religious. Like if you just say this is wrong, religious people are like, okay, they just think this is wrong, and they don't engage. But when you actually make fun of it, is when they think like they need to come and defend their religion. And a lot of times you see sometimes when people come and defend their religion, is the end result is that they change their mind. We have so many examples of people that are a fan of pages, and they say like, hey, I'm an atheist and I came to your page because you made fun of me or religion, and I came and defend Islam or Christianity, and now I'm an atheist myself. So given that, you know, stuff that makes fun of their ideas gets better engagement, kind of suggests that you're right, that this is a very powerful, I mean, there are many different ways, but I don't think we should abandon any of them. Yeah. And another thing to point out to religious people is that the Quran makes fun of, Islam makes fun of Christianity, right? Christians make fun of Islam, So, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. They should be, and all of them make fun of atheists, right? How could you possibly believe that this whole world, all this organized stuff is without God? Like, how you have to be an idiot to think that there's no great, like, they make fun, they mock atheism, and they should be able to. So I don't,
That happened. It happens, and I get why this happens. So just a week or two ago when I was on the show, there was a guy who was like, I just can't believe that you guys are fine with the notion that everything came from nothing. And Sunday night I was in Dallas doing a debate with Blake Junta again, and he wasn't supposed to be the person I was debating, but he filled in, and I greatly appreciate that. But somebody, a guest who was there with him, they like me, we get along. And yet they are baffled by the fact that I'm willing to say, I don't know. And they're like, how can you just be comfortable saying you don't know? And I'm like, because that's the right answer. Here's a question.
It's true.
A bunch of people who are pretending to know the answer or who convince they know the answer.
Right.
And yet they don't seem to be providing compelling evidence. If you ask me, you know, how is your lawn so green? I know the answer to that. I pay a bunch of smart people who have studied the actual elements that are required to grow, you know, green grass in Texas, which is not the easiest thing in the world, to come out and fertilize and take care of the lawn on occasion. Do I know the specifics of it? No, but I have a good grounding. If you ask me why there's something rather than nothing, I don't know. I'm not even sure that that's a sensible question. Maybe it's the case that there had to be something, or that there's no other possibilities. But when you tell me that you have the answer to why there's something rather than nothing, and it's because there's this transcendent magical being who exists outside of space and time and is in charge of it, that is something. Blake actually commented that it was a really simple explanation, and I laughed out loud, which I don't normally do, and I know he didn't take it personally, because while it is simple to say God did it, that's a simple thing to say, and it's a simple thing for people to get. But the actual claim that you're making is incredibly complicated. Mm. What you're saying is there exists some being not tied to space and time who has these capabilities, who did all of these. When you look at what you're actually saying, it's incredibly complicated.
Yeah, you're adding a conscious being, which is one thing so complicated, to the beginning of everything. It's just out of nowhere. Like that. That's a very, very huge claim to make. Right.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Hey, what is, you know,
just creates another question. Creates another, you end up back at square one, right?
The problems they have for why we can't explain where things come, like what are you talking about? You're adding the most complicated thing to the beginning of everything.
the whole idea is, you know, anyway,
morality. Every objection that anybody launches with regard to a secular morality is actually an objection that their religious morality or their religious model cannot solve. They say, oh, well, you know, if there is no God and you guys are just advocating for secular morality, then if you think this is moral and somebody else thinks that it's not, you have no way to resolve it. You have nothing to point to. And I'm like, well, that doesn't change just because this person is saying that they're going to point to their God, because I'm pointing to the physical facts about reality. If we can't agree on what to point to, it doesn't matter. You say that I'm pointing to God. Okay. I'm pointing to Thor. I'm pointing to pick a god. Which god should we point to? How do you get to the
and
all of these things are their objections to things that they can't solve, but they feel like they've been solved. Right. Why is there something rather than nothing? Oh, it's God. Why? What is your foundation for morality? Oh, it's God. God is this abstract panacea, this catch-all answer to everything that serves as an answer, but explains nothing.
Right. Uh-huh. I mean, even if you point to the same God, you can't seem to agree with what the same God says, right? So
yeah. Sorry, Armin, did you have another question?
I just wanted to see if we could go to the Patreon question.
We'll get to the Patreon. We just have one more topic to cover before we do. And that is, because this is actually something that all the patrons want to know about. And that's your debate with Jordan Peterson, which a lot of us watched. And so I have a small story. I'll try not to take too much time. But first of all, I see a lot of Jordan Peterson fans who come to my talk as well. And it's a big phenomenon. It's something, there's some sort of, I think there's a void that he's filling that may have been missing from the secular movement. And I'd like to get into that a little bit. But first, I want to tell you a little story. So one of my exes a long time ago, she was a law student, right? And she was part of these different groups where they all kind of got together and discussed philosophy and, thought of them as very, they thought of themselves as very intellectual and very, it was one of those, those kind of groups that, I'm talking about. And it was on Facebook, I think one of them shared a meme and it was two crows who were sitting on a telephone wire. I just perched on a telephone wire and the caption said attempted murder. Yeah. Now, okay, so don't say anything yet. So what happened is that the guy who shared it, he's like, this is so witty and it's so hilarious. And it's odd. And soon enough, it got hundreds and hundreds of likes. And a lot of these people were just coming up. They're like, yeah, that's brilliant. That's amazing. And my ex was sitting there laughing at it. And she showed it to me. She's like, look at that. Isn't that hilarious? It's so cute. And I saw it. And I'm like, yeah, that's pretty funny. And then I started looking at the comments and I realized that I didn't think most of the people got it. What? So I asked her,
That's not that surprising, but
yeah. So I asked her, I'm like, do you understand this? Do you know what you're laughing at? She's like, yeah, if the crows, they're going to get electrocuted and they're going to die. And I told her, I'm like, that's not what it means. That's not, she's like, yeah, but that's so funny. And I told her, no, that's actually not that funny. They get electrocuted and died. That doesn't make it witty or intelligent or anything. Then I explained to her that just like you have a school of fish or a pride of lions, you have a murder of crows. That's the terminology that you use for more than one crow. And she had absolutely no idea. Turned out that virtually nobody on the comment thread had any idea. Neither did the guy who posted it. This I've come to see now as the Jordan Peterson effect. It's like everybody's trying to, because it's something supposed to be witty and it seems profound. People want to feel like they understand it, because if they don't, then they'll be like, well, everybody else is getting it. I got to feel like I get it too. But in reality, even the person who posted it didn't really know what it meant. Now, I don't know. I just explained that because that I think of that a lot and I wanted to actually vocalize it. But are you there, Matt?
Yes.
Did you drop off? Okay. I just want to note, I watched that and there was a lot of discussion about the metaphorical substrate. And I heard his explanation of it and I didn't really understand it. But it reminded me of the kind of conversations that I had with a lot of Muslims. It's actually very, very similar to the kind of, when they go into abstractions and they start taking simple things and really obfuscating them, or if they, start talking about the meaning of words and going back to the meaning of what does thing even mean and so on.
It depends on what the meaning of is.
Kind of. It is. That was a famous Bill Clinton quote. And so what was that experience like? I suspect that you went through some of it. It seemed like it, but maybe I'm being uncharitable. I don't know.
Okay, so man, there's a lot to potentially address and unpack. And there are the other people
that was me venting more than question.
But, no, I'm talking about the thing in general, because I've had other people say that to them, it's like the Peterson fans are freshmen in a class. The professor says something that they don't understand, and they look around, and everybody else is nodding, so they nod as well.
Yeah,
and I've said that much of what he says, I would label a deepity, which is Dan Dennett's daughter, his associate's daughter's term for something that sounds profound, but to the extent that it's profound, it's actually false. And to the extent that it's true, it's trivial. You know, like, yeah, love is all you need. It sounds profound, but it's not really there. And I wasn't at the events that Jordan did with Sam, but Sam and I talked briefly before the event, because the one I did with him was before he and Sam went on this big tour. And it was funny because people were like, okay, define God. And I was looking for the actual quote. I read it in an article yesterday, but I can't find it at the moment. If you look at when Jordan was asked directly to define God, it is babble. They are English words. they present a concept that could certainly be viewed as deep. And yet what he has defined, actually, he didn't define anything. What he has described does not match up with the God of classical theism, does not match up with what billions of Muslims and Christians would identify as a God. We're not even sure if it's an agent. It is all metaphorical. And that's because I think Jordan is obsessed with this notion of archetypes and the metaphor, that there's something of value in belief in a God thing, even if it's not an actual thinking agent, even if it's not a being, even if it's just this abstract kind of metaphorical notion, which is why he thinks that Sam and I, and, you know, pick an atheist, that we all have gods. We just don't want to recognize that we have gods, because he's so fast and loose with what God means. If I tell him that I advocate for the principles of secular humanism and the scientific method, well, those are my gods. Those are the things in which I put my trust or my confidence for guiding my life and other things like that. And I can understand that. And I think this is why there's some appeal to him, especially amongst some atheists, because the thing that frustrates me, and I have not read his book, so I have some friends who've read his book who, Hugo and Jacob, evidently have been doing amazing critiques of it. But when you go through his like 12 rules for life, which somebody...
Yeah, he sent it to me. He sent me a copy here. And
I thought it was ironic that he said rules-based systems don't work. And then his book is 12 rules for life. But I just looked through a quick list and like one of the 12 rules, the 12 rules is speak clearly. Now, I dare anybody to take his rambling definitions or descriptions of God and honestly describe that as speaking clearly. And it seems that he, you know, Sam had a lot of trouble with him with respect to this notion of truth, because Sam and I have view truth as that which is compatible with reality, which is consistent with reality. Jordan has a view of truth that is, it's true if it's useful. That's why he's in love with so much of the metaphor, because if you can derive value for something, then it's true. But if you push him, if he's talking about something, you know, like, is this a pencil? You get a straight answer. And if you ask him, what do you mean by God? You don't get a straight answer. Mm. And I think it's as telling as anything.
Well, but, that's, go ahead, Armin.
Right. I think like when they say metaphorical or truth, it's kind of like saying alternative facts, basically. It's kind of the same thing. It's there, you call it metaphorical truth because it's not true. Or alternative medicine.
Exactly. If it was true, you wouldn't need the metaphorical qualifier.
Right. Yeah. But once the fact that the definition he has for God, I mean, this is not something new. Like a lot of people, when something is indefensible, you just change the definition to something that is defendable, right? And you just defend this new thing that weren't even challenging. That's why when people say, oh, God is love, like, well, we have word for that. It's love, right? You could just name whatever you know that exists. You could name a God and now God all of a sudden exists because we know love exists, right? And it's easy to defend, you know, that, or nature, call God nature God. And now God is real because nature is real. So I think that has something people have been doing forever. It's nothing new about that. The problem with that is that these are the same people that, I mean, Jordan Peterson fans are that argue like, listen, Christianity is so old. There must be something useful there. There must be something that keeps our civilization or identity together.
And he's right. I think he's right. If these are stories, if they're not pointing to true things, it's true beings, these stories are about us. They are about how our psychology tried to answer the questions of the world and guide our lives. And I'm fine with the notion that there's something. By the way, I found the quote or quotes. Mm-hmm. This is Jordan Peterson, asked what he means by God. Quote, God is how we imaginatively and collectively represent the existence of an action of consciousness across time. Quote, God is that which eternally dies and is reborn in the pursuit of higher being and truth. Quote,
These are all things that he said?
Yeah, it's a big list. From,
God is the highest value in the hierarchy of values. God is the voice of conscience. God is the source of judgment, mercy, and guilt. God is the future to which we make sacrifices. Now, those things are strange descriptors of God as a metaphor, actually a collection of different metaphors, because the future to which we make sacrifices is different from the eternal that dies and is reborn in pursuit of higher being and truth. These are things.
Separate things, yes.
And it's funny because if you ask my mom, what's God? She's going to give you a very, very, Jesus Christ is God incarnate. God is the creator of the universe. If you ask most Muslims, you know, to describe Allah, well, they're going to go straight to the Quran. They're going to go to the description that is there. And if you ask most of them, and I haven't, so I have to acknowledge that I'm guessing here, but based on their actions, I think this is reasonable. Do you believe that God, Allah, Yahweh, whatever, is a being, is a thinking agent that has governance over the universe? They are going to say yes without hesitation.
Right.
They're not going to be advocating for a metaphorical God. Because one of the things I think it's unlikely to happen is that you're going to run around killing people for not believing in your metaphor.
Right. And even if it is a metaphor, why is his list a metaphor? Why can't God be the greatest orgasm that there could ever be or something like that? Like, I could just come up with a different, completely separate list of great things that I don't understand. It's just like out of nowhere. Like, that's just Jordan Peterson's God. It has nothing to do with. But one thing you mentioned that you said, like, the story, it is true about the stories. I don't think it's true. The stories that you're referring to is the same stories Jordan Peterson is referring to, because I think what the value in the stories that me and I think you guys see is the stories about religion rather than the stories religion tells, right? Like when we look at Christianity and we find information there about humanity and about civilization, we see the story of religion and how it was created and how it evolved. What was the politics behind it? Well, how did it influence people? And we learn a lot from that. And why did Islam come up with this story? Where did it copy that story? So I think the stories about religion is what we see value in, not necessarily the stories religion tells us. You know what I mean?
Well, it depends. So, like, if I pull up the Bible, the story of how the Bible came to be and the human beings and their thoughts that came together to create these stories and everything else, that is incredibly interesting and useful and tells me about people. Right. There are stories in the Bible for which I'm never going to derive any use. there are also probably stories in the Bible, just like Aesop's fables or any sort of
Mother Goose,
children's metaphors, yeah, like this. You know, hey, I've made reference in some of my speeches to the Chicken Little, the sky is falling thing with regard to hyperbole, the boy who cried wolf, with regard to
that's archetypes. It's full of archetypes.
This is the sort of thing that is the foundation of what Jordan cares about. And it ties into many others. I mean, it's Joseph Campbell, who I adore, and his view of, you know, man, myth, and legend across a broad range of stories we've told over the years. I think there's value. Now, if you'd look at, for example, I'll just pick, the Jesus narrative, where they're going to portray him as the greatest heroic archetype. I don't know that necessarily fits as much as people would like. There's also the problem of, if he was supposed to be the Jewish Messiah, the Jews were not looking for a Messiah who was going to, you know, preach and be killed. Yeah. And
they wanted their land back.
Yeah, they wanted a warlord. That was their Messiah. But there's something about that character, in the same way that there's something interesting about the Harry Potter character or something from Game of Thrones. And if you view those as just stories that metaphorically tell us about who we are or who we were or who other people are so that we have a better theory of mind when we're engaging with people that, oh, I see you are this personality archetype. That can be useful. It can also not come from that. It can come from science, where for years we've been lying to ourselves about who is or isn't an alpha. You know? And it turns out that the original wolf research that went into defining this is the alpha dog and all that, it was garbage. It was a mistake. There was, in fact, no alpha. So this characteristic that we thought was truth and ran with and talked about in every context isn't actually real in the sense that we always thought it did. And yet it became part of our cultural identity about who's the alpha in the room, who's a beta in the room. Because even though it's not discreetly, completely accurate, it has become a part of our culture where you could still identify alpha-like characteristics with people.
But even when you were talking about the stories and then you said, or science, I think what you were originally talking about was also science, because you're not just talking about the stories. You were observing how people react to the stories and why they came up with this
story. Or how people get value from these. And that's something I think we all agree on, that there's a lot of people who do get value on this stuff.
No, but I don't think we're getting, actually, I don't agree with that. I think what the value that you were getting out of it is by observing the effect of why the relationship of people, like we're kind of putting people and their stories under the microscope and why they come up with the stories and what these stories tells them about them. And to me, that's basically like studying other animals. This is science, but it's not just looking at the stories and getting value out of the stories. Is asking why would the people at this time come up with this story? You know, we're observing the people and the relation they have with the stories.
Yeah, it's so the construction of the stories, that's sociology. That's telling us about who people were when the stories came up.
Right.
But the stories themselves, I think, can have information, enlightening information about who we are. Because one of the areas where I definitely agree with Jordan is that we are not particularly good at knowing exactly what it is that we believe or why. The thing I find incredibly ironic is that Jordan will tell everybody that they don't really know what they believe or why. And then he's evidently a mind reader who knows them better than they know themselves.
No, you're not a real atheist.
Yeah, he can tell me that I'm not a real atheist, or a real atheist would be murderers. Or he seems to know more about, who I am and my character than I do. And I would argue that that can be the case. Like, I know there are people I've met where I understand something about their character that they have overlooked, and it's been the same for me, where people have told me things about myself that I wouldn't have realized if not for their insight. I'm not saying that's not possible. I agree with him that we are bad at it. We're bad at all kinds of things. I'm just not necessarily convinced that, and this is going to come off as glib, and from somebody who hasn't read his book, it's probably going to, his fans are going to come after me. But if clean your room, stand up straight, speak clearly, I think those are all good pieces of advice, but I don't find them particularly profound. And there are people who are looking at him as if like he's a guru who's discovered this stuff.
Well, that's what I kind of wanted to get to that next really quickly.
But actually, he says, if you can't clean up your own room, how could you change the world? But there, we have many examples of world leaders that needed even somebody to wipe their ass. So yet they were great leaders. Like they couldn't.
No, he's probably being metaphorical. We were talking about the void. That void in the second. So is there, we're talking about storytelling. We're talking about emotional appeal. How it moves people. Is there a space for that in the secular movement? Because what we do a lot is we'd have conferences and we have talks and we write articles and op-eds. And one example that I've given here before in the podcast is that, when I was growing up as a kid, homophobia was a norm, right? Everybody used to use all kinds of slurs against gay people, and it was considered really bad. And as kids, we grew up with that. And one of the things that changed, and people used to write op-eds about it, people used to have arguments about it, they used to have conferences about, civil rights or, rights for gay people. But then when the movie Philadelphia came out, and this it didn't do everything, I'm not saying that it all changed because of it, but I remember watching that and suddenly it was a fictional story, but it was a story. And it emotionally moved me, and that changed the way I started thinking about it. So it was a story, and there was all this other cerebral stuff happening, this whole conversation that I was thinking, I was like, okay, there's this side, there's that side. But that watching that fictional account that had some kind of emotional appeal, you know, that did something to me, and it changed things. So I know a lot of people have done this with bullshit, right? Like, you know, religion is all about storytelling. It's about emotional appeal, art, calligraphy, poetry, sculpture, all of that stuff. Is there a space in the secular movement to start not just having conferences, but having, you know, comedy nights, poetry recitals, you know, people coming up and, you know, Netflix series, storytelling, but doing it with truth and doing it with reality rather than just with myths? Or is that something that doesn't necessarily sit well with you?
So I'm gonna address that question, and then if there's time, I'm also gonna address a side thing, which will probably piss some people off. But it's important.
That's great. We love that.
Yeah.
As you brought up Philadelphia. So with regard to the space in the secular community, yes. Not only do I think that there is space for that, I think it's needed. But we needed to work to get to that point. There was religions have had, at least in the West, an incredibly privileged status. And, you know, it's like, hey, what church do you go to? Or they've had privileged status with regard to tax exempt status and charities and things like that. So we had to, from about 2000 or so until now, build up the community. And that was done with conferences where people came and gave lectures, and it was more intellectual and erudite. Several years ago, Margaret Downey came up to me and said that what she wants to see at conferences is more people telling their stories. And I completely agree with her, because the one thing we find in conferences is when people show up, they get their dose of atheism, their dose of skepticism, and then they run off back and live their life. And they're not actually engaging or building communities in their town. And I keep getting email from people saying, I'm the only atheist I know. You know, hey, I'm an ex-Muslim and I'm in, you know, upstate New York, and man, there's nobody for me to talk to. And I'm like, you're wrong. There's an atheist community, there's a secular community somewhere near you, and if not, you can start one. But if we change the way that conferences in particular are done, so that they're a mix of more enlightened, erudite, scholarly talks, and just people telling their stories, that connects with people. And I love the idea. I know Travis and I had talked about having an atheist-based arts, comedy, music, variety festival, just a big celebration where everything comes from a secular foundation, but it's just, you know, joyous, and we're not going to sit around and necessarily bash religion or give an intellectual talk. We're going to engage in the things that make us human and make human life valuable and precious to us. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are other people planning and doing similar things. I like the idea of, you know, maybe a Netflix series, since we might have missed the curve on that, because for a while they were buying anything, and now they're not buying as much as they used to. Mm. But if you get some good writers together to put together, I just saw this ad for a terrible looking sitcom, a God Friended Me or something, where there's an atheist who God friends on Facebook or some social media and is messaging. It looks awful. And it looks almost like they didn't actually engage with, you know, prominent atheists at all, or people who've been active in the community or in the conventions. I will watch it just to give it a shot. Because I liked The Good Place, even though, well, what I thought The Good Place was.
Yeah, The Afterlife. Yeah. That was funny. I mean, that kind of stuff is, you know, you can enjoy it. Yeah.
But the other thing I was going to say that ticked people off is you mentioned Philadelphia. And one of the things that stands out to me that the second you said that, because it was an incredibly powerful movie, and you had Tom Hanks, who is straight, playing a gay man with AIDS.
Uh-huh.
Recently, Scarlett Johansson was just removed from a movie where she was going to play a trans individual, because the trans community was like, no, we want trans people to play those roles. And I completely understand and support that. If that was the case, you know, if this was the best way to do this, by all means, get trans actors involved. Get gay actors involved to play those roles. Get, you know, stop casting Mexicans as Arabs. You know, let's let people represent themselves.
Mm.
However, the trans issues are so important that if what it takes to get that movie made is to cast someone like Scarlett Johansson, then that's the best thing we could do. Because when they removed her, that movie is probably dead now and will never get made. And there's a story that
I agree with you. I think the whole thing about actors is that they play roles that they're not, you know, like they're, I remember when in Seinfeld, one of the most hilarious characters was this Pakistani guy named Babu Butt. I don't know if you watched the show. And we loved him. And like all of my Pakistani friends loved him too. It turned out it was a white guy, but he was hilarious and he had the accent down. I don't see, that's just not something, I don't know. I've got so many battles to fight right now.
It seems like, for example, a lot of people in Japan were not, like, what was the movie, Ghost or something? Mm-hmm. That they were upset that why was another Japanese person playing that? And they went into Japan and they asked everybody if they're offended, if they're upset. They were like, nobody said they were upset. They were happy and happy that they were like that such a famous actress was featuring their story, right?
We've done the same thing though with like cultural appropriation with regard to the dresses. My wife has this great yellow Mexican dress with embroidery on it, which she bought from a Mexican woman in San Antonio. If she wears it, somebody out there is going to say, oh, that's cultural appropriation. You know, yes, it may be. But I think we can be a little smarter about how we lead people towards realizing that sort of stuff. Because the Mexican woman who sold my wife that dress was very happy that somebody bought it, whether it was a white chick or not.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you know, if you're doing it to mock somebody like blackface or like, you know, people do with natives, that's a whole different issue. But if you're doing it to celebrate, if Gwen Stefani's wearing a sari at a wedding, I mean, that's a great thing. People in India love that stuff. Right. And if you overdo it, like Justin Trudeau did, and who, you know, like his tour.
That was wrong, not because he was doing it, because he did it in a cringy way. That was a cringe crime.
It was not a
cultural appropriation crime. It was a cringy crime. But
nobody ever gets upset at cultural appropriation when white people convert to Islam, though. I think that's really, that's the ultimate form of cultural.
Yeah,
I think it's like that. That's the one thing that that nobody will ever get upset at.
I
think one of the things that kind of tipped the balance for me, because I'm always going to try to make sure that I'm not actively being a dick or actively offending somebody or using somebody's cultural heritage or race or anything else as a prop, certainly not for mockery. But someone took... what happens is we get a really good idea and then somebody gets hyperbolic with it and runs way off the edge.
Yeah.
And I remember somebody was complaining about food, the fusion of different cultures' food they were trying to claim was cultural appropriation. And I'm like, if I put together a restaurant that fuses Indian cuisine and Mexican cuisine and I've made good food, I'm not mocking either one of them. I'm celebrating it and doing something cool with it. If you're objecting to that, you are now being the dick. You are the one that's, you know,
you're saying that it's pro-segregation to be, it's like segregating people.
But also we have to go to the Indians and the Chinese and tell them to stop practicing their culture altogether because they probably appropriated those cultures from somewhere else. Like, so everybody should just get rid of culture because everybody stole that from somewhere else before them.
Nobody gets to use rice except for, you know, Asians.
Yeah. So we're going to move on to, patron questions.
Yeah.
Before that, one last question for you, because we put it in the description. I want to make sure we cover it. We've got the political climate right now, you know, the left and the right. You've got Trumpism. You've got the regressive left. You've got all this stuff going on. And there's a question about criticizing Islam. I know I have actually heard from mainstream atheist organizers, and I met them at a Muslimish conference again, is that they said that they often shy away from inviting too many ex-Muslims or ex-Muslims there because they don't want to be, most of them are liberal leaning and they don't want to be associated with, you know, the whole Trump's animus towards Muslims, and they don't want to be seen as right wing. So they're kind of quietly shying away from it. How do you criticize Islam as in the atheist community, in the age of far-right populism and Trumpism?
Yeah, I don't think I don't.
How would you propose?
I don't think I'd change anything about the way that I've always done it, because it's about addressing ideas. Let me, you know, present your idea. Tell me what you believe and why, and I will either agree with you or disagree. We can have a conversation about that. I thought that I had been pretty left wing, but evidently I'm not left enough for some. I'm definitely not right wing, but I've had people on the left wing describe me as more right wing than them rather than less left wing than them. And there are issues where I'm going to be centrist. Like, I agree with Jordan Peterson, the government shouldn't dictate what kind of language you do. I don't think the law was going to do that at all. It may be the case that people were going to try to use the law that way, but I have confidence that we can settle these issues in the courts. Mm-hmm. But I don't think
And that's also a liberal issue. At least it used to be.
And so when it comes to Islam, if I'm criticizing a religion, I'm not racist. A religion isn't a race. I'm not actively going after Muslims or brown people or whatever, however somebody else wants to categorize it. I'm talking about ideas. And the fact that someone takes that personally, the fact that someone is offended, is not my problem. It's sad, and it's something I have to keep in my mind to make sure I'm not actively trying to do that, to offend them with regard to their personal identity. But as long as I'm talking about it's kind of like in the courtroom. The truth is always a defense against claims of libel or slander. And if I'm seeing ideas, I think that that is a perfectly justifiable explanation. So I can agree with Sam that Islam is a motherload of bad ideas. He changed it from the motherload of bad ideas to a motherload of bad ideas. And I agree. I think that's a better clarification, because Christianity is also a motherload of bad ideas. Even Jainism is a motherload of bad ideas when you get into it. Now, which ones are worse? I think if you're actively addressing the ideas, the attempts at policies, the interactions between religions and government, when you're talking about people's rights being marginalized, when you're talking about trying to build a better world, the fact that somebody gets offended that I'm going after their precious religion, not my problem. Mm. And when people want to say, there are people who will say, call in or write in actually, and say, what's wrong, Matt? Why don't you ever go after Islam? You're afraid. You're afraid of going after Islam. You go after Christianity all the time. Why wouldn't you go after Islam too? And I'm like, I will. It's a call-in show, and I engage with what the callers want to do. And also, it's an area where I don't have a great expertise. But if somebody calls in, I go after it. I don't hold back just because, you know, I don't soft pedal and go, oh, no, we can't address this because that might put me in the right-wing category. I am always just going to be straightforward and plain as best I can on those issues.
Yeah.
And what I find is that I get criticized by people further left than me. I get criticized by people further right than me. And I get praised by people on both of those sides, because the world isn't easily subdivided so that you can just dump everybody into a bucket. That's the mistake. And the buckets are getting ridiculous. I have been called a Nazi sympathizer because I am actively opposed to the idea of punching people on the street for their speech. That's it. I'm opposed to Nazis. I'm opposed to fascism. I am all for engaging on those things on an ideological level. I am all in favor of actual physical self-defense when there's a physical threat. You know, somebody's like, what are you going to do when the Nazis come after you with guns? I'm like, I'm going to shoot them because they're coming after me with guns. But if they're standing on the street expressing their ideas, I think punching them is strategically bad, and I think it's a violation of humanist principles, and I will say so. And for that, I was labeled a Nazi sympathizer. This is what's happening with people who were on the left and my friends, and people who were way out on the right. They're closer together than they realize, and they are both advocating for a form of fascism in some sense, where one of them wants, you know, government control and let's keep all the brown people out. And the other one wants complete censorship so that you can't raise ideas. I'm opposed to both of that. I'm not going for some perfectly in the middle way. I evaluate different situations on their own independently. And as long as what I'm addressing is an idea and it's clear that I'm not just mocking people, that I'm not just trying to marginalize, you come from a country that is predominantly Muslim, so I'm not going to allow you into my country. I think that's a horseshit policy, but I also don't think that it's completely unfounded for people to say, okay, where are the potential greatest risks of threats? They're not coming from Norway. They're not coming from a Catholic church. I think the Catholic Church does great harm worldwide, but it's not like those threats are the same. But just because a threat is greater doesn't necessarily mean it's a great enough threat to sideline an entire category of people who don't actually fit the category that you're trying to sideline. If you want to sideline terrorism, that doesn't just mean that you put up a wall and say, hey, no Muslims are getting in, because there's some Christian terrorists too. And there's plenty of Muslims that are never going to engage in that sort of thing.
Would you say Islam is worse than Christianity? Like many people?
At an ideological level, no. Or not much. Or it's kind of a coin toss. From a practical level, because of where Islam has power with regard to how deeply entrenched it is in government regimes and armies, armed forces and things like that, I think it's far more dangerous than Christianity.
Yeah. And I think and that's a very great answer, I think. And I think one reason why that might not be because of just what where we are in history, but it's also ingrained with it in the text, is because, you know, if we assume that the story of Jesus is based on a real person, I would say it seems if that is true, which it seems like most scholars think that, it seemed like it was a person that was trying to raise a rebellion against the religious authorities at the time, and he was unsuccessful and got crucified, just like 1,000 other people that got crucified. And Muhammad also did a rebellion against the religious authorities of his time. The difference is that he was successful, so he got to be a ruler. And because Christians followed the way of Jesus and Muslims followed the way of Muhammad, Muhammad, half of his story involves him being a ruler. And so that's why Islam is a lot more political than Christianity is by its very text, by its very nature.
Yeah, it's not just what's written in the book that defines this. It is what's going on in churches, what's going on in synagogues, and what imams are preaching. These things are it gets really difficult to define what is Christianity, what is Islam, because it's not one thing, just like religion isn't one thing. Yeah. And people are, when they come to me, they're like, why don't you speak more about Islam? Because it's, you know, there's so much in the way of human rights violations and so much in the way of concerns about violence and conflict, but because there doesn't seem to be any bend, you know, if you're in a Christian country, yeah, okay, we'll bend and we'll let the secular people, you know, have some of their rights while we keep going. There doesn't seem to be that kind of bending with regard to that. And Islam is the greatest threat to civil rights around the world. That may be true. Islam may be the most dangerous threat worldwide, but that doesn't mean it's the most dangerous threat in my hometown,
right,
or on my block or in my state or even in my country. And the very notion that there's a fallacy, the fallacy of relative privation, which is we should only focus on the biggest problem. That's absurd.
No, yeah.
Because I can't do anything about, or I can do very little about atheist bloggers being killed in Bangladesh. I wish I could. I can't. But I can do something about fundamentalist Christians trying to change the school books in Texas, which are going to go out worldwide, to fundamentally change what we teach kids about science and things like that. That's something that I can actively work towards. And so reminding people that, you know, think globally, act locally, think big picture, and act in your area to make the changes that you can.
Yeah.
If somebody said, hey, will you come to Bangladesh and give a lecture? I don't know how I could say no, but I don't know what would be involved in saying yes.
But it doesn't even have to be because, I mean, if somebody is focusing on curing AIDS, somebody might come and like, hey, why are you focusing on AIDS? Isn't cancer a bigger problem? I mean, they're addressing a problem. It doesn't have to be the biggest problem.
Right.
Let me just point it out. I mean, I don't think it even matters if it's in your area. You could be an atheist in an Islamic country, but you are very passionate about Christianity. and your activism is about against Christianity, or maybe it's not even about religion. Maybe you're a skeptic in an Islamic country, and you're fighting, I don't know, like homeopathy. And I always have a problem saying that.
Homeopathy.
Yeah. Because you, that's something that you care about, or you, maybe vaccine. People are talking against vaccines, even though you're in an Islamic country. Maybe you want to make sure telling them, no, vaccines are, you know, you have to get your kids vaccine. I mean, people choose what their activism is on. It could be as broad as
it's all your experience.
Yeah, yeah. It's based on even
not if, only that, but if we all worked on the same problem,
right?
How much worse would the world be for the problems we're not addressing?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think, and that's the other thing. I always, my answer to this is always this, you know, you can't address. There's different layers on which you have this conversation. Like, you know, you can't address jihadism without addressing Islam, because, you know, Islam is at the root of it. But you also can't just discuss Islam if you don't, if you think that religious faith can be a virtue when it comes to certain things, right? So religious faith is the root of it all, because, you know, that, as Armin said last time, that is the method by which you get to bad ideas and bad conclusions. And if you have that, if you still think that religious faith is a great way, or faith and revelation are a great way to arrive at the truth.
But Ellie, I think it's okay to focus sometimes, because you're
no, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But I still think that, you know, if you think that you can't really have an argument against the jihadists, that's why I think when it comes to secular critics of Islam, that makes a lot more sense to me than, for example, some really, that there's a lot of really religious Christians who have problems with Islam.
Because if you take that line of thinking, you could be like, if you take line of thinking, you're like, okay, so people are like, if I'm fighting Islam, people are like, why Islam? Why not just all religion? Okay, religion. And then somebody could say, why religion? Why not all dogma? Like, okay, all dogma. And like, okay, why just dogma? Let me finish this thought. Yeah. I know you're not saying it, but people say. But if you keep that going, then you go like, okay, why dogma? Why not all bad ideas? Or like, okay, I'm going to focus on all bad ideas. And like, why just bad ideas? Why not all bad things? Are like, okay, why?
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
But then even they're like, why just bad things? Why not just the concept of bad? Like, you could just go really vague if you keep going.
Yeah, you could go Peterson.
If you're in a war and you have a number of injured coming in, there is a triage process of prioritizing things. And it takes a number of things into consideration, which is, okay, I can fix this, I can't fix that. The other one is, this is the patient that's closest to me. Right. You know, various. This is the most emergent case. You can
use the patient I care about the most. It's my brother.
You might get into moral quandaries there as well. But it's certainly the way people often go about things. And for example, for me right now, it's 9:35 here in where I live in Austin. What's the most important thing for me to do? Well, right now it's talking to you guys. Because if there was something more important, I would have already hung up and I'd have gone and do it. And so I can prioritize this for now, because this is a really good use of my time for a period now. But tomorrow, am I going to come back and talk to you guys again? Well, no, we need to wait some period of time before there's any need or desire to act. And I've got, you know, I'm in the process of getting a divorce and separating stuff. I'm rebuilding a whole new studio over here. And people are like, why would you build a new studio? Why aren't you out, you know, feeding the homeless? I do that too. but, you know, and maybe tomorrow the most important thing for me to do, just for my own mental health, is to go play poker or go play pool or do something, see a movie, because you can get fried and burnt out if you don't balance things out in your life. And if somebody comes up and says, oh, I donated $400,000 last year to diabetes research, and you donated $400. So clearly I'm more moral than you. Well, if we had the same amount of money, that I would agree, you have done more good than I have. But that doesn't make me a bad person. And it doesn't mean that I failed to do as much as I could reasonably do.
Right.
Yeah.
Patreon question, so, Ali. We have to
really let's do it. Yeah, so really the very first one from Jim King. Oh, this is about your tweet, Armin, about the whole incident. I think, should we save that for an AMA? Let's save that for an AMA.
No,
it's not really related to the topic.
I don't know. I want to make sure we answer Patreon. Like, really quickly, I don't think we can answer really quickly.
Yeah,
but
it's not.
No, let's ask it. Let's just be fair to our patrons.
Okay, so he's saying, ask Matt if there's anything wrong with incest if both relatives sincerely consent and there is no procreation.
That's not enough information to reach the conclusion. I ended up having a lot of conversations about this, so I'll give you the shortest answer I can. Are there situations where I have no moral objection to incest? Sure. Yeah. I don't know how many of those are really feasible. We know of things about kin attraction, and we know people who entered a relationship not knowing that they were related. There may be, you know, if there's no procreation, set aside all the genetics, that his particular example doesn't exclude the possibility that a parent groomed a child their entire life to be
our dynamic,
but they became it. So yes, so those sorts of issues lay into that question, but the blanket statement that incest is immoral across the board, I can't buy that.
Right. But any okay. issues that you would have with it would be the same issues we would have with a non-incestual relationship. So
yes.
It's not the incest that makes it bad. It's the power. If there's a power dynamic, well, we have a power dynamic problem with non-incestual.
It's about, yeah. It is about informed
consent.
Reasoned consent.
Right.
And whether or not people are taking responsible actions.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, so let's move on. From Mars Chung, if there's... can you ask Matt how he approaches sophisticated theology and how apologetics are able to find justifications for liberal values?
I think we were reading that. Didn't we?
Yeah, I think we did, yeah.
Yeah.
Christianity taking credit for Enlightenment values and so on. So, Michael...
That's kind of two things. So, on sophisticated theology, I'm not convinced that any such thing exists. I actually call it obfuscated theology, because I couldn't agree more.
Yeah,
the arguments William Lane Craig presents are exactly the same as Ray Comfort's. They just sound better.
Right, it's hiding really dumb arguments behind really complicated words.
Well, a really good example of this is it's creationism and intelligent design. So intelligent design came in, and that was supposed to be a sophisticated one, but it really is creationism just dressed up in a very nice way.
So for example, this argument that the God is the greatest, imagine the greatest thing, and now because you imagine it must be, is like, you could really dumb it down. We're like, okay, I'm imagining the most delicious ice cream in the world. So does that now exist? If you take around the wording that they use and just present it in a simple way, I think most people can recognize how dumb they are.
You can't do that with just delicious. There's something about greatness that actually includes existence or...
The greatest evil. How about the greatest evil? Can you do it with the greatest evil? Okay. So if there is the greatest good, then there should be also the greatest evil, but they don't have that because the devil is not all powerful like God is, right? So
The other problem with that is that they just assume that the greatest possible thing necessarily exists because it would be greater to exist than not exist.
Which
is a little bit of a bait and switch, but also there's a good response to that I like, even though
I know this one.
It's not going to be convincing, which is it would be much more impressive for me to be able to create a universe without even exist.
So that actually proves that actually based on that argument, God should not exist because
All
right.
There's two questions that Michael asked that actually kind of go together. So I'll read them both. First, what is the most common fallacy you've heard during your debates? And the second is which of the well-known apologists is the most ridiculous? Putting you on the spot. I think he wants to name names. Yeah, that's going to be your call.
When I say that William Lane Craig's arguments are the same as Ray Comfort's, I guess I'm implying that Ray is more ridiculous, when really it's just he's not as good at relaying the same argument. There are some individuals that actually half of my debate opponents probably have made similarly ridiculous claims. Mike Lacona, who's a smart guy, basically argued for the supernatural on behalf of Ouija boards and moving trash can lids, and it was just bizarre. Cy Ten Bruggenkate is a presuppositionalist who doesn't even really completely understand the precepts that he's parroting when he talks about this stuff. And, you know, Matt Slick is also, you know, smart guy, but they get stuck in sort of a loop, a defense loop of how do you know that? How do you know that? You know, you could be a brilliant of that without actually acknowledging the fact that neither of us can solve the problem of hard solipsism, pretending like you have just makes you look ridiculous. As far as the most common fallacies, probably argument from incredulity or argument from ignorance. But it might actually, the thing is, depending on how they structure the argument, the fallacy could change, because most people don't put together a syllogism. Most people are speaking in plain, and you're going to find there's a bunch in there. And it may be that the most common one is an equivocation fallacy, which is kind of what I addressed on Sunday, because the question was, can faith be rational? Well, if by faith you mean confidence level, then yes, you can have a rational confidence level. If by faith you mean the foundation for belief instead of evidence, then no, that's not rational. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening is they argue on behalf of this type of faith in order to bolster this other type of faith. And that happens even when it's not the most obvious fallacy, because it's a problem of language.
Mm-hmm. So, next question. I'm going to go to Jim again. Jim says, a number of studies have shown a link between attending religious services and living longer. It may be due to having a support group and not feeling like one is alone in the world. How do you see non-religious people forming similar congregations or congregating, organizing?
I think we're already doing that. Like I said, we needed some time to begin building up the community, but we're doing that with Oasis, Sunday Assembly, Skeptics in the Pub, just building up communities, the Atheist Community of Austin, pick another secular community, recognizing that we're human beings who generally, not everybody, thrive in social situations and decline when we're on our own. There's a benefit to cooperation and working together. It's not surprising to me that people in active communities live longer. It's not a testament to the truth of their religion. If it were, it wouldn't be true for all of these various religions. You know, they, not just like the First Baptist Church of Harvester. Those people live 4 years longer. It's religious individuals across the board who are actively attending and participating in group stuff.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And just a shout out right now for people in Canada in general, look up Greta Vosper. She actually runs the Westfield United Church, and she's also involved with the Oasis. I've spoken at both, and these are both sort of Sunday assemblies that are non-theistic, and they're fantastic. I had a great experience with them.
Do you think what do you think about people that want to build something like a church, like with singing and... something that celebrates, I don't know, humanist values, kind of.
That's exactly what it was. What I spoke at was Oasis and Westfield United.
Right.
They actually had songs about, but they were about love.
What if people say, like, now you're turning like, I know this is ridiculous, but what if people say, now you're turning atheism into a religion?
Yeah. So one other thing about the religious thing that might do it is a lot of religions discourage things that might cause you to live a shorter life, like drinking and smoking and things like that. There are religious people who do all those things, but there are religious prohibitions against some that could factor in. I don't want to see atheism become a religion. I want to see atheists doing the things that religions stole and tried to co-opt for themselves.
Yes.
Sunday Assembly.
Taking it back.
Those things are not what I would normally do on my Sunday if I had Sunday off. Just because I have enough of that going on the rest of the time, I will happily speak at them. It's not for everybody, but it's for somebody. And nothing irritates, well, there are a few things that irritate me more, but few things irritate me more than when atheists say, oh, you're just creating an atheist church, and why can't you get over this and, you know, just go on and live your life without it? Nobody should do that. Well, now you're a dick because you're telling other people how to live their life. If it's not for you, don't go.
Right.
But telling other people that they shouldn't go and interact with other people or sing or hold hands or have a potluck or actively work together to make the community better, you are not contributing to the betterment of the world.
Right.
You don't have to go. But when you start telling people they're wrong to go or wrong to want to go, that for me is a huge...
And it can be something informal too. Like, again, the group... Muslimish here in Toronto, I haven't been able to go to a lot of their meetups because, you know, I have family and weekends are, you know, limited and so on. But their next event is actually a family picnic, is where people bring their kids and everything like that. And it's not really a speech thing. It's not a secular thing really, but it's just people getting together and we're going. It's easier for me to make it out to that. So I think that it can bring more people into the fold for that reason, building communities.
Is Burning Man turning music and drug religion?
Yeah.
when you go to your football game, I think you're probably closer to having football as your religion than if you're an atheist or go to like
right. Yeah, so nobody says that about football fans.
I mean, I took a religion course. There's two elements that make something a religion based on definition. People getting together doesn't make it a religion. It needs to be, there needs to have a supernatural element, and there needs to be rituals. If you have these two, then you have religion. Like, for example, astronomy is not a religion because it's supernatural, but there's no rituals, right? But I think these are the two elements that make something a religion. I don't know if you agree with that.
Rituals. I don't know if I go with necessarily just those two. I mean, there's probably going to be a number of different definitions for religion that I would accept.
Right. Yeah, I think I would kind of agree with... Sorry, go ahead, Matt. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just saying those two could be. I'm just not necessarily convinced that that is the best or preferred. I mean, I don't have any objection to it. Mm. I'm concerned with how we define religion. That, you know, so it's kind of like porn when the Supreme Court was talking about... They didn't put a definition on it, but it was kind of a we know it when we see it thing. And I think that that's fine.
Yeah, like Yuval Noah Harari talks about communism being religion and, you know, a lot of these other things too. So, and they have common elements. But anyway, so let's move on.
There's a specific definition of a cult that people have used. And in that context, it's, you know, with you being removed from your family and not, that sort of thing becomes cult-like. On the other hand, a cult is what the big religion calls the little religion.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a cult, the only difference between a cult and a religion is size, honestly. So just really quickly, I guess we have around 10 or 11 more minutes. So from Mars, in the debate with Jordan Peterson, you discuss morality. Jordan Peterson seemed to sneer at basing morality on well-being. Your thoughts seem to parallel Sam Harris's. Yeah. Can we anchor morality objectively to realism?
Yes. I mean, I gave a lecture for years on the superiority of secular morality, and I stopped giving it when Sam came out with The Moral Landscape because it was just much easier to tell people to read his book, because while we don't agree on absolutely every fine point in it, it largely expresses my thing. We are physical beings in a physical universe. The rules of the universe dictate the consequences of my action. They also dictate what is or isn't in contributing to my well-being. The rules of the universe also could dictate whether or not it's contributing to society's well-being. It's not just well-being may be ill-defined, but it's not just some arbitrary thing. It's not just a matter of opinion. If I lop your head off in almost every possible circumstance, that is definitely not in your best interest.
I liked what you said in there where you said that, well, once you've lopped my head off, the being part of well-being is already gone. Right? There's no, you're not, it doesn't exist. So
that I
that was a great line.
It was the first time that it happened where I came up on the fly, because it struck me that there was not that he was being intentionally obtuse, but because he has an understanding of what should be a moral foundation, that even when he was willing to concede well-being, he couldn't see how we could objectively address it. And why not being would be in conflict with well being.
You can't go more. There's only a limited number of ways in which you can interpret that. From Reason on Faith, this is just a comment, and I think it's a good comment. He's talking about a subsect of Muslims called the Ahmadi Muslims, and he is an ex-Ahmadi Muslim himself. Ahmadis are actually persecuted by all other Muslims. They're frequently killed, and they go through horrible things. So he said, I agree with Matt about the moderate types giving air cover to the more fundamentalist types, and this is why I believe it's important to tackle the feel-good memes of Ahmadi Islam, which mistakenly paints Islam in general as peaceful and somewhat progressive.
Ahmadis are actually some of the most peaceful people in the world, and it's very dangerous because they're making it seem like Islam is not dangerous,
and they're saying that's what Islam is all about, right? So they're kind of giving cover too.
So again, these are if somebody is peaceful, like if we're saying they're dangerous, we're not talking about the people are probably awesome people. We're just talking about the effect of spreading these ideas that there's nothing wrong with Islam, it's kind of dangerous. And this is very important coming from somebody that comes from the Ahmadi community and acknowledging that. So
you know, I've been asked before about this thing about is Islam a religion of peace? My answer is simple. No, I'm not convinced that any religion is a religion of peace. I think that's a gross oversimplification. Can it be? Sure. Under specific interpretations with people cherry picking, you can make any sufficiently exhaustive text that has served as a foundation for religion, you could build a religion that is a religion of peace or a religion of war, because life isn't that simple, and what we constructed in religious texts isn't that simple.
Right. It's more about the method of coming to what works instead of just like deciding like, hey, I'm going to... I mean, the problem with even the peaceful interpretation is that because the method is so faulty, it's not a reliable way of getting to peaceful and prosperous solutions, right? Even if we by accident end up getting into a good one. But go on.
Yeah. So next question from Michael is, Jordan Peterson an atheist? That's it.
Under my definition, I think that he is.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between whether or not somebody fits the description of atheist and whether or not somebody self-identifies as an atheist. Mm-hmm. And he has been reluctant to self-identify as pretty much anything. So when you're talking about how people personally identify, if somebody tells me they're a Christian, I'm going to take them at face value. Maybe they have this esoteric definition of Christian, and maybe by him believing in God in a metaphorical sense, that might exclude him from being an atheist. What I will say, once upon a time, somebody in the atheist community said, we all know Trump's actually an atheist. And I gave the talk immediately after them and said, no, actually, we don't know that. And the guy has said the opposite. And even if he was an atheist, I would acknowledge it as a fact of truth, but I wouldn't claim him as an atheist within our community or anything else. Whatever Jordan Peterson is, he is not a skeptic. He is not a humanist. And I don't view him as part of the atheist community.
What pronoun would you use for him, though?
Confused.
Oh, yeah, I'm kidding. Just a joke.
He's not a humanist, but while he mocked humanism in that discussion and suggested that Soviet Russia was secular humanist. And it's true that Soviet Russia was secular, but the comparison between the principles of setting up a government as like the ruling body, revered, you couldn't question, and humanism, those things aren't even on this
Actually, you know who else said that? Yuval Noah Harari, it didn't say exactly that, but if you read his book, Sapiens, he actually says humanism, he has different kinds of humanism. The whole way he defines humanism is that, we basically center everything about human beings. And he said religion did that, and then liberal humanism did that, but then communism and all that, they did it too. So,
no, but I want to get back to Jordan Peterson. Why do you think he's not a humanist, though? Like, I know he said something about, I don't really see much value with what people identify as. If somebody comes and says, hey, I believe in a conscious creator of the universe, but I identify as an atheist, they're free to call themselves whatever they want. But based on the definition of what an atheist is, they're not an atheist. I mean, whatever they identify as is irrelevant, I think.
That's also why I think he's not a humanist, because what little time we actually spent talking about humanism, he completely misrepresented it and did not seem to value it, and seems to think that you can't have a moral foundation without appealing to God either as a metaphor or as an actual agent. And that is the antithesis of a foundation for secular humanism.
Right. Yeah. So I'm gonna go on, and because we just have like about 3 or 4 minutes left, so we've got some more. We've got some comments.
I just want to mention the Calgary one. Make sure we mention Lewis.
Sorry, which Calgary one? Can you read it out?
Well, in Calgary, like Lewis Edward is saying, in Calgary, we are creating a community similar to what you are describing. About atheists getting together. I just want to give them a shout out. Our organization is the Atheist Society of Calgary, ASC. Great job, Liz. That's awesome. Good job.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. And so I want to, we'll finish with the last one here, just from Mars. He's saying, how did you learn how to debate like you do? And how would you suggest learning how to do it?
Well, the self-promoted traditional idea would be to say, watch my Atheist Debates Patreon channel where I go through things and describe it in great detail. Well,
yeah. We're going to do that at the end. We're going to tell people how to find you. Yeah.
I really can't answer this because when I was a kid, I think I was in a debate class for one semester and it was a train wreck and I don't know that I actually learned anything. The way I got and the process by which I developed whatever skill I do or don't have was I just did it. I did the work of navigating my way out of religion. I had a good understanding of that. And then I talked to more people. And then I started writing stuff for websites and I would engage in written debates and discussions with people. And there were loads of mistakes made. When I started doing the TV show, I've hosted the TV show for 14 years, taking countless live calls on all sorts of topics. And they haven't all gone well. I mean, there were some huge mistakes early on where I remember one call where we were asked to give our thoughts on the ontological argument. And Russell and I gave our thoughts on, or maybe it wasn't even Russell, maybe I'm misremembering, but we gave our thoughts on the cosmological argument. And when you make mistakes like that, whether it was us mishearing or just a brain fart or whatever, I'm my own harshest critic. When I leave the TV show, when I leave a debate, I am replaying it in my head going, oh crap, you should have said this, you should have said this. And actually, I'm getting ready to do a video tomorrow or the day after, because after the debate with Blake was over on Sunday, I had a conversation with somebody else. And in the process of having that conversation, I came up with a far better analogy for what we were discussing that I think imparts so much clarity into it. So I jotted it down. I actually went over and told Blake and he got what I was saying right away. And I think it would have been useful in the debate. So you take notes. Mm-hmm. And I've done videos where I give tips on things. Number one, you got to be willing to change your mind. You can't go into these things saying, I'm right, you're wrong, and here's why. Mm. So you have to have the right goals. And if the right goal is to actually have a conversation and to get closer to a better understanding and help somebody else understand and help you understand, that to me is the right motivation. I don't, even on the TV show, people pull out the clips of here's Matt on a rant or here's Matt, you know, smacking down Christians left. I hate those videos because they don't represent what's actually going on. They're just amusing. Mm. Go into it with the right frame of mind. If you actually care about the conversation and building a better world, you're going to do fine. You're going to make loads of mistakes. Be critical of yourself. Take the criticism in. Don't worry. You're going to get loads of criticism from people who are also wrong. I learned very quickly, I can take a call on the show and get an email that says, my gosh, you have the patience of a saint. And an email that says, you are an impatient dick, and talking about the exact same call. And so you have to realize that everybody's watching these conversations with their own baggage. And I try to go into every debate or every discussion, assuming that somebody is hearing all of this for the first time, and that I have an obligation to be the best representative I can be. And I also go into it knowing that I am going to fail to be the best representative, but knowing that helps me get better. And then it's just practice. It's a skill. It's in part theater, because you have to actually develop a relationship with the audience. There's a reason why they don't get to dismiss me as easily as they might dismiss, well, Dawkins, for example.
So
if you're in a Southern Baptist church and you want to have a debate, the people in that church can easily dismiss Dawkins, even though they shouldn't. It's not like I've necessarily got better responses or arguments than him. But they will dismiss him, and they can't do that as easily with me because of the background and because of, you know, having done so much of this.
It seems like Mars is asking his question because he wants to learn from you. He's saying, I really want to be able to do what he does. He kicks ass in debates. This is something I'd love to learn. Maybe your path towards this is different from other people. Like, do you have any, if somebody is interested in getting better at debates, maybe they should, we'll give a shout out to how people can come and watch your videos and where to find you. Do you think that's a good idea to basically like see how you do it? Or do you have any other advice?
Watch a lot of debates and don't just watch mine. Like I post mine and then I post deconstructions of them to show the mistakes that I made. You got to be critical of yourself and your positions. You should probably be more critical of your positions than your opponents, because when you understand the objections to yours, you're going to know how to argue better on their behalf. I won't do it, but I could defend.
Don't you also have to see if your opponent's coming?
Can you finish that thought? That was very important. You could.
I, I could defend Christianity better than a good chunk of the people that I've debated.
Yes.
I won't do it because I know I could, because I know the impact of it.
But doesn't it depend on whether your opponent is coming from a position of good faith or not? Because sometimes people will, they'll know that you're being more self-critical. And if they know you're being more self-critical, they'll, there are some people who will exploit it. They'll keep on interrupting. They'll try to take you off into tangents. And I've noticed this happens a lot with religious people that I debate.
Go ahead, finish that. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about saying this though. So why don't you do that with your videos, like make like a steel man version of Christianity and then debate yourself? Like you could make, like do black and white version where you're like steel manning their arguments and then switch to this is how you would respond to that. So you
so could, I don't want to do their job for them. If they can't do a job, I don't
want to help them. Why would you want to give them arm the enemy? But yeah, because going back to that.
How to fight the best arguments. But anyways, okay.
Yeah.
You'll get accused of straw manning, no matter how accurate you are.
Yeah.
You're still going to get accused of that.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. But how do you deal with, if you're being self-critical and, you know, how do you deal with an opponent who is sort of exploiting that and trying to, so derail you in a way because they're not coming from a place of good faith, for lack of a better term.
I have no problem flat out exposing that. Mm-hmm. Because if it's the truth, so one of the things that I try to do when I'm setting up the structure of some of the debates, I don't want a collegiate 4 points debate, you know, joint press conference or that. I want to actually have a conversation because I trust that a good chunk of the audience, the portion that I think is reachable, will be able to tell who is actually thinking and responding and who is just regurgitating something that they heard or something. Mm-hmm. And I'm fine with interruptions. And matter of fact, in the last few debates I've done, it was, let's do it as a conversation where I get to ask you questions for 10 minutes. You get to ask me questions for 10 minutes. And the time belongs to the person who's asking the questions. So that if I ask you a question and you're not, I don't like your answer, I don't think you're getting there, I get to interrupt you. Everybody knows I can interrupt you to bring you back to the question. And I trust that the reachable portion of the audience is able to tell the difference between someone interrupting in order to prevent a good point being made and someone interrupting in order to bring someone back to the question hand because they're often rabbit trails. Mm. And so if somebody is trying to exploit, you know, this, I'm happy to call that out.
Yeah.
Thing is, I try not to go negative or aggressive until after they've done it. Because if you maintain the high ground, if they start going really low, you can go a little lower and still look like you're, you know, way ahead. Uh-huh. But at the end, if what you're saying is true and you are being reasonable and you are honestly sitting there thinking about and responding and trying to interact, and the other person is trying to avoid or manipulate or use some tactic, I trust that the reachable portion of the audience can see that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We've taken more of your time than
thought. Tell people where can you find you?
At MattDillHoney.com is pretty easy. Also, Atheist Debates or Patreon.com/AtheistDebates. But if you just Google my name, you'll find it all. The Atheist Experience TV show, the Patreon.
Twitter, and yeah, everything.
They're all linked from MattDillHoney.com.
And we'll put them all in the description here.
Yeah, but some people listen to the podcast, they don't have the notes. But I just, there are some videos you do that really, on your own channel, that really breaks these things down into the most simple, like really ideas that seem like very complicated that other people made complicated for no good reason. You really break them down in such a digestible way. So I think if anybody is interested in debating these topics or even just having an understanding of how to approach some of the arguments people have about faith or religion, I think your channel is such a great resource for that. And I can't recommend it enough. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah. It's, I do this because I love it. And I'm very grateful to the community because for 4 years now, it's been my job. I left my software job and I produce 3 videos a month for the Patreon thing. It's managed to keep me from losing my house and afforded me much more free time to go around doing lectures, debates, magic shows, and using the magic to teach skepticism.
Which is such a great way to show to teach skepticism, because basically you're seeing something that seems like something. I mean, to kids especially, it's such a powerful way to make them skeptics, because they could see something and they know there must be a reason why this is happening. It's not real. And when you show them, I don't know. I think it's the best way.
Say, you know, all those miracles that you read about. Well, you know.
No, but to kids, you need to demonstrate things instead of explaining sometimes. And I think magic tricks is a very powerful way of doing.
Oh, I loved it when I was a kid. I loved magic. I still do. It's just something I don't get it. Anyway. There you go. That was a very good version of it.
Our patrons are saying, thanks, Matt, for your answer. Great show. One of my favorite guests that has been on the show. Mike is saying, Matt is extremely interesting guy. I can listen to him for hours. Mars is saying, I called into the show once. It's awesome. Oh, Mars here one time called into your show at one point. So thank you. Thank you, our patrons. This is great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it. I'll come back whenever you want.
The Secular Jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends, write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions, or head over to secularjihadists.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air, and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.